The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Leslie Crutchfield, author of How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
There's a lot in the news these days about social movements, such as Me Too, Never Again, and a number of others. Have you ever wondered if there were certain patterns or practices to these movements which will ultimately help determine how successful they will be? Well, it turns out there are, and they have been chronicled in a wonderful new book entitled How Change Happens While Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. And it's a pleasure to have with us Leslie Crutchfield, its author, who also serves as the executive director of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. Good evening, Leslie, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what wonderful timing for a book like this to come out. I read your previous book, Forces for Good, and in it, you stated that the best organizations created movements, not just organizations. Was that a jumping off point for you to get started with How Change Happens?
That was exactly the inspiration for this new book on why some movements succeed and others don't. We knew that what made great nonprofits great from our study in Forces for Good, nonprofits like Teach for America, Habitat for Humanity, Environmental Defense Fund, and many others, the distinguishing factor was that they were all about driving for these larger causes. With Habitat for Humanity, it wasn't just about building houses. It was how do we make poverty housing politically, economically, and religiously unacceptable in this world? So they had these big, hairy, audacious goals, as Jim Collins would call it.
Yep.
And so we knew movements distinguish high-impact organizations from others. And then this question kept rattling around in the back of my head, what makes a great movement? And so that's what led to this recent study, which we've been engaged with over the last several years to try and tease out the answers.
And what was the general time frame you looked at and researched when identifying successful and not so successful movements for this book?
We specifically looked in the modern era, so changes that have happened since the turn of the 21st century. So even though many of the movements we studied might have had a long tail, have been going on for decades, we wanted to understand how do you get to a tipping point in the 2010s, right? So we looked at movements like the ones that led to the massive abandonment of smoking in this country. Smoking rates are now down to 15% for adults, under 6% for youth. We looked at gay marriage equality. And we looked at the gun rights movement. At the same time, we looked at movements during the same era that weren't successful or might be stuck or in some cases are just emerging, like the movement for Black Lives and other newer movements. And we were trying to figure out what's the delta? Why do some get that tipping point and others don't?
Well, in the book, you identify six practices of successful social movements. So let's run through each of them, starting with turn grassroots gold. And when I read that, you know, it reminded me of Tip O'Neill saying that all politics is local. And this just might be the most important recommendation that you make. What did you find out?
It is the most important recommendation, and that's, in fact, why it's the first chapter in the book. It might seem obvious. Of course, every movement, you know, has grassroots activism, protests, demonstrations, voter turnout. So it was really surprising to me and my colleagues at Georgetown University, who are working with me on the research, that some movements just don't master this. They might have a grassroots, but they don't invest in it. And that means real money, time, resources, amplifying and nurturing the grassroots and realizing that change happens from the bottom up. You know, President Obama had a very good saying after the Supreme Court passed the marriage equality ruling in 2015. And he did say love is love, but he also said change comes to Washington, not from Washington.
Yeah.
And you got to have
great
a big,
point.
Robust grassroots to achieve that kind of change.
Good example of that would be the NRA, correct?
The single most important factor, which explains why the gun laws are the way they are in the U.S. today, is exactly because of this point. It's the way the NRA and gun rights movement leaders have mobilized, organized, and amplified their grassroots. So while it might look like an even competition if you just were an average person watching the mainstream media coverage of the gun control movement and the gun rights movement, in fact, the media is pretty biased to the left.
Yeah.
The reality is that the gun rights movement since the 1990s has dramatically expanded to the point where they dwarf the gun control movement if you're just looking at the grassroots measure. So let's use 2012 as an example. That was the year of the Sandy Hook shooting massacre. Mm-hmm. And we all remember what happened in Newtown with the 26 students and educators that were killed that day. At that time, the NRA had already built up to nearly 5 million members, whereas the biggest gun control group at the time, Brady, was about 500,000. So the gun control movement at the grassroots was 1/10 the size of the gun rights movement.
Interesting.
So everybody says, well, why after Sandy Hook, if they couldn't have gotten a law passed, if we couldn't have got anything done, what would it take? What could be more horrible than that? And it's a great question. What's changed is that since then, the gun violence prevention side of the equation has really mobilized and ramped up. So after the Sandy Hook school shooting, Shannon Watts, mother of four in Indiana, put together Moms Demand Action, started a Facebook page. That merged up with Mayor Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns, and in 2014 created Every Town for Gun Safety. Now, at the time I finished my research last fall, Every Town was up to about 4 million supporters. Post Parkland, they're ready to tip past 5 million. So for the first time in 2018, you have a gun control movement that's equal in volume and intensity at the grassroots level, matching the power of the NRA.
So you got a fair fight for the first time. It should be interesting to see what happens. You know, another example, which I don't think we think of very often, is polio. Because when we think about polio, we think about the World Health Organization and we think about the Gates Foundation. But actually, there was a lot of on-the-ground support for that as well.
Exactly right. The reason why we are this close to eradicating polio from the face of the earth, we have put it out of business and 99.9% of the populations on earth, is because of Rotary International and its 33,000 chapters and its millions of boots on the ground in every country. In fact, when I was interviewing Bruce Aylward, the intrepid director of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative for decades, he says that he and Bill Gates and their staff will never take a meeting anywhere in the world without a Rotarian by their side, because they realize that the boots on the ground grassroots aspect of Rotary's network is what drives the political and social will in these countries to make polio eradication a priority. And that's what you really need. You can telescope it up globally on a cause like polio, or you could telescope it down into your state or city and think about how you can mobilize the grassroots against the cause.
The second practice you cite was to sharpen your 10, 10, 10, 20 equals 50 vision, which, if I dare say, was quite eye-opening for me. And you really captured this by describing what the LGBT community did. Share that with us.
Well, certainly the 10, 10, 10, 20 equals 50 vision is a tongue twister. It actually comes straight out of the playbook of the marriage equality movement and the LGBT activism to have same-sex marriage recognized in this country. And the origins really have a story behind them that happened right here in the New York vicinity where we're speaking. In 2005, the leaders of the marriage equality movement gathered in a conference room in Jersey City, New Jersey. They'd been brought together at the invitation of Tim Gill, a mega donor involved with this cause. And at this moment in time, LGBT marriage equality movement did not look like success was going to be inevitable. It actually looked impossible.
Yeah.
So you had DOMA. President Clinton had signed a law defining marriage as only between a man and a woman. 13 states had ballot referendums underway to ban gay marriage. Many other states already had laws in place. The only place where it was legal for a gay person to marry was Massachusetts. Even in Massachusetts, there was a vociferous opposition underway with Mitt Romney, leaders of the Catholic Church, organizing to try and repeal the marriage law that had been put in place. So the movement was on the rocks. And kind of in desperation, the leaders were meeting Evan Wolfson from Freedom to Marry, Mary Bonato, a very famous lawyer in this movement, others, Matt Coles from the ACLU. And they said, well, let's just do a thought experiment. What if we broke down the country and we said, let's take 10 states and see if we could actually get full marriage in those states. And we'll take 10 states and just go for civil unions. And another 10 states, let's see if we could even just get domestic relationship recognition laws in place. You know, these things are separate and unequal, but they're better than what we've got. And then in the balance of the states, 20 or more, let's just try and get the discriminatory laws off the books. So the idea was if you could get each state to sort of take one incremental step forward from wherever it was starting from, you would get this groundswell of momentum behind and support for marriage equality. And that's what they did. After that meeting, they divided up the country, mm-hmm. and each part of the movement could sort of work on what they wanted to work on in those states. And ultimately, they succeeded.
They sure did. This is the beauty of the 10th Amendment.
Well, in fact, we hear a lot about the First Amendment these days and seeing students exercising their right to protest in support of tighter gun laws. And of course, we hear a lot about the Second Amendment these days as well. But it really is the 10th Amendment that defines which way the policy pendulum will swing. And movements that figure out the 10th Amendment, of course, is the one that grants the majority of rights to the states mm-hmm. and reserves a very small amount of federal power. If you recognize that and you drive your movement to achieve change at the state and local level first, you're much more likely to win. The other thing is, you know, think about it. For as successful as the gun rights movement has been in the last several decades, have you ever seen a big gun rights march on Washington?
Never.
They don't do it. They don't march on the Capitol. They go to the state capitals.
Yeah,
they
right.
go to the city. They go to municipal level.
They know where
level.
The action is.
They know where the power lies, and they are very savvy at putting pressure where it will actually make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Your third practice is change hearts and policy, with a lot of emphasis on that word and. These are not mutually exclusive. Tell us how they work together.
The reason why we framed hearts and policy together is by default, if many movements are resource constrained, you know, you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot of time, you say, well, let's just try and go for these policy changes, right? We'll open an office in D.C., we'll lobby, we can get meetings, you know, with representatives. But it's actually changing hearts, minds, opinions, attitudes, behaviors that goes hand in hand with changing the policies so that when the laws change, people believe that those laws are the right way to go. And the other thing is when movements are focused on changing people's views and opinions about an issue, you've got to come at it head on. So let's take, for instance, out of the tobacco control movement. Now, no other modern movement has saved more lives or prevented more disease and suffering than the tobacco control movement. What they came up against was the realization that while they could put taxes on cigarettes and try and, you know, depress the buying and use of cigarettes that way, they realized that the ultimate opposition here wasn't just Philip Morris and the tobacco companies. It was Marlboro Man, Joe Camel. You know, there's a stat that at one point, Joe Camel name recognition was greater than Santa Claus in some poor children's communities.
That's frightening.
It's very frightening. So they realize they're up against these iconic brands, Marlboro Man, Joe Camel, and their beloved people identified themselves by what they smoke.
Mm-hmm.
The smoking was ubiquitous. It was frequent. It was fashionable. It was in the movies. It was in the magazines, even in hospitals. You know, you all can remember doctors and nurses smoking. So these, or you just have to watch one episode of Mad Men to recall, you know, how ubiquitous smoking was. So tobacco control realized we've got to make smoking as uncool as the spin masters out of Madison Avenue working for the tobacco companies were making it cool. And so that's what they did. Some of the most effective campaigns out of the tobacco control movement are from the Truth Initiative. These were targeted at young people originally at Gen X, who, you know, a couple decades ago were the millennials of their era, or I should say our era, being a Gen Xer myself.
Mm-hmm.
And tobacco control advocates were very keen and savvy. They said, what defines the Gen X psyche? Well, we're slackers. We're apathetic. We don't care. It was grunge. It was Seattle, right, at the time. And they said, okay, so if you want to appeal to Gen Xers, you've got to get into that rebellious spirit. So the ads and the media campaigns at the time were all targeted around, well, corporate leaders and the tobacco industry are these guys in suits, and they're trying to manipulate you and hook you into smoking. So if you really want to be rebellious, rebel against the man and don't smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked. There's a lot of evidence out of the first campaigns in Florida that
right.
showed attitudes and opinions really shifting among young people around smoking. Today, the Truth has done research into millennials and next gen young people. And they less about rebellion for rebellious sake, more about they really care about social justice. So you'll see ads this year around the Super Bowl about racial profiling and why cigarette companies are putting menthol and promoting that. Of all the African Americans that continue to smoke, the majority choose menthol. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very targeted and, frankly, racist approach. So how do you tackle it that way? Or you have, you know, on YouTube, Catmageddon, these silly cat videos that have gone viral.
That was good.
It was a great video.
It really is.
You know, the punchline is, if you smoke, secondhand smoke can kill your pets, no stupid cat videos. It got right at what tweens care about, mm-hmm. which is their pets and watching silly pet videos on YouTube. You know, and the beauty of it is it didn't say don't smoke. It wasn't one of these boring, you know, kind of traditional PSAs saying smoking's bad for you. It was savvy and modern and clever, and it works. Yeah. And that's the most important thing.
Quite hip. Fourth is reckon with adversarial allies. And boy, I found this to be such well-grounded advice and a reality check, because people and organizations working on the same cause are not always pulling in the same direction. Tell us about that.
Whether your cause is winning and triumphant or struggling to succeed, every cause and every movement has internecine warfare. You've got internal strife. You've got nonprofits and individuals fighting over money, credit, power, authority. Who gets to be the one to open up the, you know, speeches on the protest march? Who's going to testify before Congress? You know, I heard stories in different movements, winning and losing movements, of big gorillas in the field calling major donors and telling them to pull the grant of the other organization. just really crazy stuff. And the stakes are high in all of these movements. So there's no secret sauce. There's no recipe that will show you the five action steps to overcome strife in your movement. I think what we found was that winning movements like marriage equality, like tobacco control, even gun rights, were able to find enough common ground among their disparate members to move forward. And going back to the idea of the 10, 10, 10, 20 equals 50 strategy, that actually turned out to be a beautiful way to overcome some of the internal strife in the LGBT marriage equality movement. Because going back to that meeting in Jersey City, New Jersey in 2005, you know, one of the reasons the movement was on the rope was that they were all in conflict with each other. There was a camp of LGBT advocates that wanted to go for full marriage, mm-hmm. right? And then there was another camp that said, why do we even want marriage? Why do we want to be like straight people? It's too traditional. It's too mainstream. We need to go our own way. We're queer. And then there was a camp that said, why are we trying to go for marriage? I just want to have my partner recognized so that I can visit them in the hospital if they're sick, right? So you had this extreme diversity of opinions from, you know, far left to far right and everything in between. So the beauty of having that 10, 10, 10, 20 strategy was, if you wanted to just get discriminatory laws off the books, go for it. If you want to go for full marriage, go for that. It gave you everybody an ability to do what they thought was right, all generally pulling in the same direction, but not necessarily having to sing the exact same tune. They were in harmony, but not all singing the melody, if that makes sense.
It does. The classic big tent is what they were able to create. Fifth practice is break from business as usual. And this addresses the role that business, who sometimes is looked upon as being adversarial, but they have really played an important role in some of these successful movements. Tell us about a few of them.
Certainly the counterintuitive role in business was one of the big ahas that came out of our research. You know, we came in with the frame that many people hold, which is, you know, activist digging in their heels and protesting corporate wrongdoing. And certainly that was the case in the tobacco control and the tobacco wars over the last several decades. But in most of the movements, we started to say, well, what role did business play if you didn't have a powerful industry opponent? Mm-hmm. For instance, with gay marriage, there was no entrenched economic interest that stood to lose ground if society granted this right. So, you know, we saw business actually being a playing field for these changes to take place. So, for instance, with LGBT marriage, you know, one of the dedicated strategies early on was in the state of California. Advocates from ACLU and other organizations were working to get relationship recognition laws, getting companies to recognize same-sex partners on their benefit rolls. LGBT affinity groups within big corporations, entertainment, finance, tech industry players out in California were advocating from the inside, so that by the time the state of California was voting to reinstate gay marriage, of course, California had allowed gay marriage, then they had a backlash and they banned it, and then they were voting whether or not to reinstate it. At that point, 80% of people working in California already received benefits if they so desired. So the norm had shifted in California because the businesses had changed their corporate policies. And that led to these larger norm shifts, right? The default was, sure, we recognize same-sex partners. That's what we do, rather than that being a fringe or minority part of business. We saw in every movement the business is playing a role. And now, of course, you're seeing it more and more in this post-Parkland era after the shooting tragedy in Parkland, Florida. Pretty soon after that, you saw big businesses like Walmart's, Dick's Sporting Goods, dropping assault weapon sales from their shelves, raising the age voluntarily at which young people could purchase a gun. Bank of America announcing that it was going to no longer lend to companies that manufacture firearms. So these are really big, bold steps, and they have repercussions. I mean, if you look, go back to the tobacco control movement, a few years ago, CVS Health elected to stop selling cigarettes, and it was embracing its shared value vision of becoming a health and wellness and beauty company. And instead of selling cigarettes and chew and all the stuff that comes along with it, they were moving into, you know, specialty pharmaceuticals, minute clinics, and all these things. When they stopped selling cigarettes, they lost $2 billion in sales.
I recall, yeah.
It was a big hit. Now, they have bounced back and actually more than made up in that revenue by focusing on the wellness side of the business. So did not come without a cost. But and a lot of times I'll be asked, you know, what should corporate leaders do? Should they weigh in on these things? And I think the best advice to whether you're in a corporate foundation or a strategy group and you're thinking about how to engage with movements is to think about, you know, does this fit in with a larger vision that you have for a company? And where are you trying to go? And if you're trying to embrace shared societal, environmental, economic value, and it fits in with a narrative that you're already building, then it's probably worth doing. If not, it's going to come across as inauthentic and potentially you'll get backlash.
That's right. Things need to be in alignment.
There were a couple other ways that were interesting insights into how businesses contributed to advancing or sometimes thwarting movements. Certainly, companies also played a role as advocates and educators. You know, when it came time for the Supreme Court to hear arguments about the gay marriage case, at that point, hundreds of companies were signing on to Friends of the Court briefing. And these were, you know, everything from ConAgra to Xerox and everything in between, not just sort of elite liberal coastal companies, but Heartland America type of companies, too, because they knew that was something that their employees wanted, customers wanted. And often businesses are the bellwether, and it takes a while for public policy to catch up. Whereas it's kind of counterintuitive because you think of businesses being sort of conservative and sluggish and the last to come on board. Another way we saw business engaged in movements was certainly doing what they do best, which is making products and making a profit. So commercial technologies, Dicorette gum, 800 quit lines, you know, you can, these also contribute to the abandonment of smoking. They're certainly not a silver bullet, but it's part of the mix. And then that last but not least, the other big trend that happened during this era that we're looking at, really at the turn of the 21st century, is the way that businesses have become really hyper-exposed to media and consumer glare because of the advent of technologies, new media. You know, now, you know, in a single tweet, an individual can influence millions. And you saw this, for instance, when in the gun control debate, when a conservative pundit, Laura Ingraham, criticized David Hogg, one of the students from Parkland, about something. And he implored her advertisers to abandon her. And they dropped her like a hot potato. That is the power of the internet equalizing and democratizing things. So this all started, you know, just in the last few decades. You also have all this extreme activism, right? Like Greenpeace volunteers started skydiving off of smokestacks and commandeering whaling ships. And these actions on the front line of a company's operations was different than sort of a little picket line around the, you know, sidewalk around a headquarters, right? Yeah. Like this was, and this was media friendly, great content, made great video. And so, you know, companies find themselves on the crosshairs very easily when they're doing stuff wrong. And so there's more impetus, I think, today to try and get on the right side of many of these causes.
Can't agree more. And the sixth and final practice is to be leaderful. And this is a little bit like the porridge in Goldilocks and the Three Bears. At least it was to me. Not too hot, not too cold, but just right. How is being leaderful just right?
Movements that are leaderful operate between two extremes. And on the one hand, on the far left, you have movements that are leaderless, right? They're chaotic. There's anarchy. There's no clear leadership. Remember Occupy Wall Street?
Actually, it's right downstairs, Zuccotti Square. We're about 100 yards from it.
Yes. So, you know, you had all of this protest and activism and the call for the 99%. And they purposely had a leaderless structure.
Mm-hmm.
It was purely democratic, no hierarchy. They had dozens of different demands. And what happened? You know, it got a lot of attention and flared bright and then kind of fizzled. Oof. On the other extreme, you can have movements that are too leader-led, top-down, controlled by the elite institutions, often out of Washington, D.C. And leader-led movements tend to hoard power. They hoard credit. They're not pushing authority, responsibility, and limelight out to the grassroots and the chapters at the state and local level. They're keeping it to themselves. And what you want to find is a balance between those two, where your base of power is still coming from the grassroots, but the grass tops is really providing direction rather than commands. And I think of it as the leaderful movements have leaders who really are playing the role of a conductor of an orchestra, trying to get all of the different actors out there to play in tune rather than the commander of a military unit or a traditional CEO.
Yeah. And Mothers Against Drunk Driving would be a good example of that, correct?
Mothers Against Drunk Driving is a great example. In fact, there's a terrific quote from Candy Leitner, the founder of MAD, who says, as she was starting all these chapters and the organization was growing like wildfire across the country, her advice to any movement leader and advocate is this: never open an office in Washington, D.C. And she, you know, MAD started out in California, then they moved their headquarters to Texas and where they still are. But the power has always been out across the land with local and state organizations. The other thing is leaderful movements really put the people with the lived experience of the problem front and center. So whether you're a victim or a survivor of a drunk driving crash or, you know, any of the issues that we're talking about, those people that have that lived experience are the best and most passionate and articulate spokespeople. So pushing that credit, authority, limelight out builds momentum. And it also keeps you from getting suffocated from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Very smart. Were you surprised, Leslie, by anything you found, or perhaps more to the point, things that you did not find as being critical to a successful social movement?
One frame that we did this research, one frame that we used while doing the research was kind of traditional social movement theory, right? And a lot's been written about civil rights era movements, scholars coming out of the 60s and 70s. There's also a lot of great social movement scholarship that's come out since then. But the frame is around the mental model that we hold is kind of contentious collective action, right? It's protests, it's demonstrations, it's angry mobs of activists. And while sometimes contentious protest was part of movements that we studied, a lot of times it wasn't. The movement to eradicate polio certainly has been arduous. It has required enormous resources, efforts, and sacrifice, but it hasn't involved protests, right? And the nature of that issue doesn't necessarily lend itself to that. So that was one thing. The other thing, I think the timing of this book has been really fortuitous. You know, we started writing it in 2014, long before the populist movement that resulted in the election of Donald Trump. I believe that in many ways, that populist movement and Trump's ascension to power has been the anvil upon which many of today's movements are being forged.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at Me Too, what's coming out of Parkland and Never Again, the teachers that are out protesting, not for their own pay raises, but for a raise for all the kids that they teach, the gymnasts that are banding together against that pedophile coach that was preying on them for years. There's something today about the power of collective action. Individuals who individually are pretty powerless, and only by linking arms and together commonly advocating on a purpose do you see the balance of power shifting. And I think a real bellwether of that is the Fortune magazine rankings are out this month, the 50 greatest world leaders list. And for the first time since Fortune's done those rankings, it's not a CEO at the top or a president of a country. It's the students from Marjorie Douglas Stoneman High School. The number three slot is Me Too. There's movement sprinkled across that. That shows just how important collective leadership models have become in this day and age.
You know, one thing we haven't discussed, Leslie, is money and the role that it plays in social movements. What did you find out about that?
Well, we looked at money and the role of money, but it's not a chapter in the book, and we don't really get that much into it because it's one of these things that all movements need to have. A lot is helpful, but it's necessary. Money is necessary to succeed, but it's not sufficient to explain why some movements succeed and others didn't. So let me give you an example. If you just look at tobacco control and gun control, with tobacco, despite the fact that tobacco companies dwarf the gun industry in annual sales, the tobacco industry is so much more powerful than gun manufacturers. You know, tobacco growing states, you know, had relationships with all the politicians representing those states. They employed most of the ad firms here on Madison Avenue. They employed the lobbying firms. So they had a lot of power, connections, cachet. But the tobacco control activists were able to overcome. But the reverse is happening in the gun issue, right? You have, you do have wealthy gun manufacturers. Some are going out of business, but many are stock continues to rise every time there's one of these shootings. Yeah. You know, the stock goes up. And in this case, the gun control activists have not prevailed. And it's because the gun manufacturers have a gun rights movement on their side. And that is explains why, in that case, it's winning. We also looked at the role of private philanthropy. You know, certainly the concentrated funding of in the LGBT marriage equality movement, Tim Gill and other mega donors, concentrating that on how do you advance this larger campaign rather than just trying to fund, you know, individual nonprofits helped. In the tobacco control wars, it cannot be underscored how important it was that Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the largest health foundation in this country and probably in the world, exclusively focused on public health, poured $750 million into the tobacco control movement over 10 years. And that gave the tobacco control activists the fodder that they needed to fight fire with fire, you know, to do these ads and to fight the Marlboro Man and Joe Camel. It's expensive. And you also had to have funders who realized that it's not just about policy change. You got to market and do social norms change, right? The other thing is when you look at the breakdown of how Robert Wood Johnson Foundation spread its money, a good amount went to the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, the national advocacy group, which really was a coalition of American Heart, Cancer, Lung, other groups, and their membership bases. Most money went to the Smokeless States Coalition, so hundreds of millions of dollars into state and local small coalitions that were passing these state excise taxes and doing things at the state and local level that where they could undercut the tobacco industry because at the local level, tobacco control activists had more power, whereas the tobacco lobby and the industry leaders had power up on Capitol Hill. But that's not ultimately, again, we go back to where change happens. So you got to have some money, but it's not the single.
End all and be all. Yeah. Absolutely. So in gathering all this research and interviewing countless people, were you able to identify some essential truths about how change happens?
A few fundamental truths really crystallized for me and my team. And I worked very closely with Bill Novelli, the founder of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative, which I work at Georgetown in the business school.
And the Campaign for Tobacco-Free
Bill
Kids.
Bill was the founding president of Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. He was CEO of AARP. He founded Porter Novelli, the global communications firm. So he's had a lot of experience on the ground. And I spent several years studying this stuff. And we came to three conclusions. First, change is possible. Even in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds and powerful industry opponents, you see movements winning. And you also see movements not winning. But the point being that it's possible to change things, especially in this day and age. The second insight is that change is nonpartisan. You know, with the gun rights movement success, you got Tea Party, libertarians, conservatives winning the day. But on other causes like LGBT marriage, tobacco control, liberals, progressives, they're winning. It's not one party or even one faith that rules at the end of the day. You know, God doesn't appear to be on any one side of these causes. And if multiple gods were involved, there clearly is not consensus. The third point is this. Change is deliberate. At the end of the day, social change making is an act of leadership. These changes did not happen by chance. Smoking did not go out of fashion. We didn't just grant marriage equality to LGBT community members because it seemed like the right thing to do. And gun rights have not become so expanded and gun laws so lenient in the U.S. by chance. Mm-hmm. These were deliberate acts of well-led, well-organized movements. And the other point that was fascinating is that the leaders of these movements, while they were leaderful, they also were just kind of everyday people. You know, the drunk driving movement founded by Candy Leitner was created by somebody who was a real estate agent and a mom of two kids. Many of the leaders of these movements, their backgrounds would not portend that they would go on to have so much impact in society. Some were lobbyists and politicians and had some skills in that area and training, but most weren't. And it belies the fact that truly anyone can lead if you have the gumption and the passion and the relentless pursuit of impact. And it's not preordained who's going to lead these things.
We as individuals can really make a difference. Well, Leslie Crutchfield, the author of How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Now, the book has a website, correct? Tell us about it, what's on it, and where people can go and get the book.
HowChangeHappens.com. It's got all the good media and commentary that we've done, where to buy the book. But really, anywhere that books are sold, you can get the book. And the ideas in it really are to help any individual, whether you lead a nonprofit, whether you just donate to a movement, whether you are a target of a movement. We hope that these ideas can help you advance your cause.
Well, I bought it, I read it, and I got an awful lot out of it. Thanks, Leslie. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.